Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and today I'll be speaking with Alexander Maxwell about his book, Choosing Slovakia, Slovak Hungary, the Czechoslovak Language, and Accidental Nationalism. It's published by Taurus Academic Studies. And it's an intriguing rethinking of language and identity in the process of the emergence of a Slovak national identity. So it's my pleasure to welcome Alexander Maxwell to the program.
Hello, Alexander. How are you doing today?
Very well. Nice to talk to you.
It's wonderful to have you on and talk to you about your book, Choosing Slovakia.
Nice to be on.
Well, and this is, we have done international before. We had David Crowley and Susan Reed from Britain, but from New Zealand, that's a real treat. And that's, and the wonders of Skype. So, I guess the first thing we'll talk about, just to give people a little background, I mean, how did you get interested in Eastern Europe in the first place and then end up writing a book about Slovakia?
Well, like a lot of illustrious predecessors in East European studies, I started off being interested in Germany. There was a point in my life where the only thing I wanted to do was to move to Berlin. And it so happened that I spent the summer of 1989 in Germany, improving my German, and hoping to enroll in the Freie Universität Berlin in the fall. And that sort of fell through. So I went back to America to continue the university studies I was doing there, which meant that I missed everything. When the wall came down, when communism collapsed, I was in California, you know, sick that I wasn't in Europe, that I was missing everything. So I started reading every newspaper I could because it was the only thing I could do to feel in touch with these biggest events. And that introduced me to the very inspiring person of Václav Havel. Before I knew it, I was very interested in Czechoslovakia and pursuing Czechoslovak history and reading Czechoslovak, reading about Czechoslovak history. When I eventually got to Germany as an exchange student, I then started taking Czech language. And before I knew it, I had completely lost interest in all things German and had started, you know, my career as a Czechoslovak expert.
Okay. And you know, Slovakia is not exactly the place. I mean, you already mentioned Havel. You didn't mention Dubček or Slovak people. What was the move to Slovakia in particular?
The story behind that is as follows. I lived in Prague for a year. Then I, you know, went to Japan, did some other stuff, went back to Prague, and tried to study Czech very intensively before going to graduate school. And then when I got to graduate school, my original plan was to write a history of Czechoslovak nationalisms in the plural. I was always interested in this question of contingency. So my original plan was to write about Bohemian nationalism, Moravian nationalism, Slovak nationalism, Czechoslovak nationalism, Czech nationalism, and Pan-Slavism as sort of a competing horse race, or I'm not quite sure what I imagined. It's a long time ago. But since I had spent all this time in Prague, I felt that I didn't know anything about the Slovak half of Czechoslovakia. So the very first paper I wrote in graduate school for Stanley Payne in a Europe Between the War class was about Czechoslovakia in the interwar period. To sort of balance out my knowing more about Czech history than Slovak history. And that paper that I wrote for that class was sort of the kernel around which the whole book crystallized. And I ended up never getting around to researching any Czech nationalism because there was just so much to say and so much to learn and so much to read about to get my head around what was going on in Slovakia.
Well, and we have a book for it, as you say.
Indeed. Well, I mean, Slovak studies is a rather understudied discipline.
Exactly.
I ended up writing my first master's thesis on Macedonia. There's all kinds of super smart people who have written about Macedonia, but the pickings on Slovak literature in English is really quite slim. So I was hoping that my book would stand out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly raises some interesting questions. So why don't you just start talking about, the basic argument of the book and how you frame it?
Well, there are two main themes to the book. The one theme is contingency. I'm interested in how people acquire the nation that they get by studying how they reject the national ideas that they're not interested in. If a historical actor in Slovakia says, "I'm so proud to be a Slovak," that's boring. If a Slovak historical actor says, "I'm so proud to be Hungarian," or "I'm so proud to be Czechoslovak," or "I'm so proud to be a Pan-Slav," ooh, tell me more about that. So the book consciously emphasizes these sort of paths not taken, and that's one of my main interests as a historian, to look at this contingency. The other big theme in the book is the relationship between national loyalties on the one hand and linguistic loyalties on the other. I think a lot of scholars of East European national movements presume that those will be the same. I mean, in your own field in Ukrainian history, I remember Yaroslav Hritsak, who read my second master's thesis, which was an early version of this book. He was very surprised by my argument because he said in Galicia, you have the Russophiles who believe in a Russian language, boom. You have the Ukrainophiles who believe in Ukrainian language, Ukrainian nation, boom. And there was no equivalent camps in the Slovak case in the same way. Everything was all much more complicated than that. So I found out that I had to distinguish the story of national loyalties on the one hand from the story of linguistic loyalties on the other. And the story of linguistic loyalties turned out actually to be much the more compelling.
Well, this all takes place in the context, as you were, you mentioned what was going on in Galicia in the, mid-19th centuries and camps. It all takes place in something we talk about as the national, often called national awakenings.
Yes.
How do you understand a national awakening as they occurred in the 19th century? What's the context and your understanding of that?
The term national awakening is contested, and I believe that was actually how we first came into contact with each other. We had an email discussion over the term national awakening, if I recall. Do you remember that?
I do remember a very lengthy one. I know we were talking about it. I don't remember all the specifics of it. I just know there was a lot. There was a lot of.
It was a long time ago.
I mean, ink isn't quite digital equivalent of ink spilled on that is what I think of it.
The electrons spilled. Many people are unhappy with this term national awakening because they think that it presupposes a sleeping nation complete in all details that merely is awoken to its perfect self. There's no room for cultural construction or contingency in the national awakening metaphor. I accept this objection, but I'm unhappy with all the alternatives that I've thought of. I don't like to think of myself as studying nationalism per se, because a lot of people think that nationalism is a study of nationalist violence. I looked at my CV the other day. I've published, 20, 25, however many articles, all on nationalism, and there's not a violence on any of them. I published on national mustaches, on national sexuality, on national grammar books, on national landscapes, and at no point is anybody trying to kill anybody. So the National Awakening is more specific, a more specific descriptor than mere nationalism. I also think that it's just sort of an accepted term for this period in Czechoslovak history, or East European history generally. I mean, people just talk about the National Awakening as a, you know, as a time period. The Renaissance is also a phrase that we might interrogate or problematize, that the European culture did not pre-exist and therefore could not be reborn. But people just refer to that period of time as the Renaissance. So I'm happy with the concept of National Awakening just as a placeholder for a certain time period. What I think is really going on in this time period is that there is a shift in the origin of political legitimacy. I think that the monarchical principle, where you obey a monarch, an emperor, a king, who is ordained by God, this loses its cachet. People no longer believe in that. So what happens to replace it? What happens to replace it is that people imagine this community that they call the nation. And they imagine it in a variety of different ways that are very interesting to compare and contrast. And slowly the idea of the monarch disappears, and in place you have these new forms of contestation. The divinely ordained monarch does not lend itself very well to religious tolerance. If you obey the Habsburg emperor because he's a good Catholic, how is the Habsburg emperor then going to view a Protestant or as someone who's Greek Orthodox? That's very problematic. The whole point of his legitimacy is that he's a good Catholic. Or again, in the Ottoman case, if the Ottoman Sultan is legitimate because he propounds the laws given in the Quran, if you're not a Muslim, how can that be a legitimate state? The nation is better at that because we can belong to the nation whatever religion we have. But when people imagine the nation, they imagine new forms of exclusion. They imagine the nation defined by, for example, speaking a common language or common imagined descent. And then people who don't speak the right language or don't have the right descent suddenly are excluded from a community that there hadn't been any problem with them belonging to that community before. I find this great period of transformation fascinating. So I think all of my research, both this Slovakia work and the work I'm doing on Hungary now and other projects I've done, is centered on this transformation of political legitimacy from the monarchical principle to various imagined communities that we call nations.
Okay.
So I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, sure. No, it's helpful. And you also seem to, I think, you put it in a broader context, not simply of Eastern Europe, but I think you refer, I believe, in your introduction to Peasants and Frenchmen by Eugene Weber.
And I think the title of that book, Peasants and Frenchmen, is the most concise, most eloquent description of the National Awakening process that we have. It may not be the best book, but the title is the best title. So Peasants and the Frenchmen, we can apply that anywhere. So I came up with a Weberian title for my book. So the title for my book is to explain why peasants turned into Slovaks by examining why peasants didn't turn into Hungarians, didn't turn into Czechoslovaks, didn't turn into Panslavs. Nice.
Oh, yeah, okay. And I think that actually gets at my next question, which is going to speak about how the Slovak case fits into this story. But let's move on then to some of the issues you raise also in your introduction about conventions. And I think what I like about this, you mentioned an issue where you were unable to reproduce a Slavic black letter typeface. And it struck me that you're sensitive to something that a lot of scholars aren't necessarily, just how important typefaces was as they're coming to grips with what it means to create a print culture.
Something that's very important in the Slovak case is deciding what type of spelling, what type of grammar we want to use. Most scholars refer to that collectively as the choice of literary language. I found myself compelled to reject that term utterly. I found it very difficult to understand how linguistic nationalism worked unless I distinguished very sharply in my own mind the idea of a national language as opposed to a dialect or some other classificatory status from the linguistic practices that are the objects of contestation. So if you have a grammar book and the grammar book says, grammar of a Slovak grammar. Well, on the one hand, that is a series of linguistic rules, standard spelling, a standard grammar, whatever it is. So the literary language. And I wanted to call that a script. So that book corresponds to a script. And the reason I didn't want to call it a literary language is because oftentimes the linguistic rules described in that book, the script, if you will, were in the mind of the person who wrote the grammar book, not corresponding to the classificatory status of a language. A whole bunch of Slovaks codify a literary dialect. They write a grammar book, they say this is the Slovak grammar, and then the introduction clearly talks about the Slavic language, spoken from Kamchatka to the White Sea, spoken in on the Adriatic, a Pan-Slav language, of which Slovak is merely a dialect. I think people have a lot of trouble recognizing that as a theoretical possibility. People assume, well, if you write a grammar book that's distinctively Slovak, obviously you must believe in a Slovak language, in Slovak languagehood, if you will. But that turned out not to be the case. Because I had to distinguish sharply between linguistic practices and the national associations that people made of those practices, I found it very important to distinguish linguistic, the fine details of linguistic codification in what I think some readers may find as technical details. The letter R Hacek, for example, is strongly associated today with Czechness. And so people say, well, that's a Czech letter. Well, many of my Slovaks write a grammar book that uses that letter, or write an essay that uses that letter. And in the content of the essay, they say, we love our great Staroslovenskina, we love our great old Slovak. So is the letter Slovak or is it Czech? We need a way to refer to the letter without ascribing it a national ethnonym, because otherwise we become confused between the name we give the linguistic feature and the contested national meanings that historical actors give to that linguistic feature. The classic example in my book is the Kolar's Hlasové, which is a book written against Ludovic Štúr. It's a defense of what I in my book called Bibličtina, the sort of old Czechoslovak tradition, if you prefer, the orthography of the Kralice Bible. Now, Kolar's defense of this script is normally described as a defense of Czech. This is Kolar defending Czech against Štúr's Slovak. That's the normal description. But if you look at the people who are supporting Kolar in this dispute, who are preferring the old Bibličtina spelling and rejecting Štúr's new spelling, you see that they defend that same old spelling in that book as Czech, the way you'd expect, but also as Czechoslavic, also as Czechoslovak, and once even as Slovak. There's someone who says, this Štúr script is nothing more than Czech. We stick with the Bibličtina because it's our true Slovak. So this is very hard to understand if you don't distinguish the linguistic name from the national ethnonym. That character, that historical actor would then, in the normal terminology, he would be defending Czech as Slovak and attacking Slovak as Czech. That sounds very controversial and paradoxical. But if you say he was defending Bibličtina as Slovak, attacking Štúrčina as Czech, then it becomes easy to understand what we're talking about. So this is why I became very interested in typefaces, though, because I had to define these different orthographies on the basis of linguistic characteristics, which I, in practice usually meant spelling. If I would look at a text and I would see an arhatchek, I would say, ooh, this text has an arhatchek. If I looked at this other text and it had the A umlaut, which is associated with the modern Slovak, it's from Hatala, ooh, there's a text that has an A umlaut. And if I had a text that had both an arhatchek and an A umlaut, which I did find, then I had to say that because I thought it was important that that text, that the spelling of that text didn't correspond to any of these broader categories. Now, it is an important feature of the book, the shift from the black letter alphabet to the Latin letter alphabet. And if I could make that book an ideal book, you know, every time your book is published, you have certain problems with it. But if I could go back and make that book an ideal book, then there would be black letter text for black letter quotations. And but that turned out to be impossible because I couldn't find a black letter font for my computer that had S hotcheck and C hotcheck and all these things. The people who make black letter fonts assume that they're for Germanic languages only. So they have A umlaut and U umlaut and an S set. Sometimes they have Scandinavian, you know, the O with the diagonal slash.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that's called. But you can't find C hotcheck in black letter. And I actually looked into designing my own font and couldn't figure out how to do it. So I gave up.
What do the writers that you deal with talk about Latin versus black letter, or what is more Slavic or Slovak or Czech?
They do talk about it. They sometimes ascribe it a national dimension or a tribal dimension. Other times they talk about it as old-fashioned versus more modern-looking. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis. But I think what's most interesting, though, is that they view them as different alphabets, not as, you know, different fonts or different varieties of the Latin alphabet. But the distinction between Latin and black letter in the minds of 19th century Slovaks is as great a jump as the gap between the Latin alphabet and Cyrillic. You know, the Serbian is written in Cyrillic, Bulgarian is written in Cyrillic, Ukrainian is written in Cyrillic, Polish is written in Latin, and Lusatian Sorbian is written in black letter. And that's a totally separate alphabet in their minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's, you get that line. I mean, you hear it from Germans in the 19th century and even the early 20th century, certain directions where they say, you know, we should stick with our black letter because, you know, well, the Russians have their own alphabet. Why shouldn't we? You know, and it that poses a problem, I would think, for a Slavic black letter writer or a proponent, because they they can't really say it's their own because it's already kind of international.
In the minds of Germans, the black letter is uniquely German, but in the minds of Habsburg Slavs, that's not really the case. They see it as their own alphabet. I did notice an interesting thing once, though, that, I mean, the black letter alphabet, there are multiple black letter alphabets. And I've seen a couple of songbooks where, you know, for example, the main text will be in Slavic, but there will be a footnote and it'll cite a German language book. Or it'll be a black letter text and it will cite a German phrase in the middle of the Slavic text. And I noticed that they use a different black letter alphabet for the German as for the Slavic. So there's the Fraktur versus Schwabach. And so I actually thought of writing an article once about the different types of black letter as claims to linguistic purity and so forth. And I had actually started that article. But what happened in the end was that I had a catastrophic computer crash and I lost all of my images and I couldn't find them again when I went back to the library. I found a terrific book of it was a book about the Schleswig-Holstein debate. So it had German and Danish, both in black letter, but in the same black letter, whereas the Czech-German black letter then would be distinguished between different types of black letter. And I thought that was interesting.
One of the weird things of reading 19th century documents in German is they'll suddenly use Latin and they switch to the Latin handwriting, even that we as Americans are familiar with, and then they switch back in to the to the bureaucratic hand that they use. It's kind of jarring but interesting.
Mm.
And I think there is definitely more work to be done on that as an image and issue, because it's something that I think you're particularly sensitive to, and it's worth thinking about.
I actually wanted to make that the main feature of my career, because I realized I was seeing things that no one else was seeing, and I developed a vocabulary that no one else was developing. But I had this terrifying experience in my first ever job interview that the search committee looked and said, oh, I see you published on Hungarian dialects. I see you published on this. I see you published on that. Are you actually a historian? The historians look at this sort of thing and say, oh, well, this is linguistics. It's not my own discipline. Linguists look at it and say, this is some crazy, bastard history. It has nothing to do with our discipline. I've fallen through the cracks completely. I found that being interdisciplinary was disastrous on the job market. So I moved away from linguistic nationalism to look at things that were more classically historical topics, nationalism theory or cultural history and so forth. But now that I have my job and now that I'm established, I want to return to linguistic nationalism in the future. And that will be the subject of my research over my sabbatical, which begins next year.
Wow.
So I will be working on this in the future. But I consciously moved away from this field of study because it was so toxic on the job market.
Well, let's move back to it and elaborate a bit more about the process of language codification, both as historians generally talk about it and as you see it, and how are the differences. And I also like you to talk a bit more about the confessional issues that arise, in Slovakia, because I think most people, who work in Eastern Europe or, are not particularly focused on Slovakia, tend to assume that it's this is largely an issue of Catholics with a smattering of some Greek Catholics here in the East, who may or may not be Rusins. Some decide they're Slovaks eventually, others don't. Just could you elaborate on those topics, please?
The question of language codification has two dimensions. On the one hand, you have the person who writes the grammar book and what linguistic ideology that person may or may not have. But on the other hand, you have the question of who actually learns to read and write in that alphabet, in that script, according to those conventions. So that leads you to more institutional history. Who is learning these scripts is students in schools. So who's schools? And you have the situation that schools are frequently run by churches or religious institutions. Now, if you have a situation where there are multiple faiths in one region, like Hungary, even in the Slovak parts of Hungary, you have Catholics, you have Lutherans, you have Calvinists, and they have different schools. You may find that the teachers of the sort of Slavic language in those schools prefer different grammar books. You may find that they prefer different grammar books. So I found it necessary to distinguish the Catholics with their Bernalakovchina, Calvinists with this East Slovak that I wasn't quite sure who had codified it, so I called it East Slovak. And then the Lutherans, who are the most active, they switch. They start off being interested in the Biblistina, and then they switch to Sturovchina, and then they eventually adopt Hatolovchina. So it was important because the institutions of language learning are associated with churches. So that's why it played a role.
And to what extent is there a sense that we're Catholics, we don't want to mess with your Biblistina? And by the way, for those of you who are not familiar with Slavic languages, Biblistina comes from the word Bible. It was the way the Slovak Bible was translated, if I understood correctly.
And that's correct. I wanted to name all of the different scripts, not in terms of an national ethnonym, you know, the Slovak script, the Czech script, or even Stur Slovak, Hatala Slovak, Bernalak Slovak, but rather to name them only after the person who codified them. So Hatala script is Hatulovčina, Stur script is Sturovčina, and so forth. Because this traditional way of writing that's more or less uncodified ultimately derives from the prestige of the Kralitsa Bible, I called it Biblichtina. And that's not my own coinage. Lots of people talk about Biblichtina, both primary sources and secondary sources. I'm afraid I've forgotten the question, though.
Well, I was just, you know, curious as to, you know, to what extent the different faiths are saying no to language and, you know, how important that is. And how does that get overcome?
There are people who don't want to write in that good-for-nothing script that's used by those lousy people who have the wrong religion. That plays a role in the early stages. As the threat of modularization becomes more and more severe, as the national movement starts to become the dominant force in politics, these confessional questions sort of fall by the wayside. The Slovak intelligentsia, whether they're Catholic, whether they're Lutheran, whether they're Calvinist, see modularization as a threat, and so they come together to fight that threat. The key moment in 19th century Slovak history is the codification of a pan-confessional script, and it's codified because Stur and some leading Catholics get together and compromise. So in a sense, that fits into that broader story of the decline of divine power and the rise of national power, the decline of the monarchic principle and the rise of nations, because the confessional divisions fall away, and instead you have national movement for a national orthography and a national spelling and so on and so forth.
Now, what is... You know, how many people sort of are going to schools and learning Slovak in, say, 1830?
Hardly anybody. I would suggest even in 1900, hardly anyone is learning Slovak. And this is it's actually one of the most interesting things about the Slovak case, that even as the literacy rate goes up and up and up, the knowledge of any given Slovak spelling doesn't really go up. I think most people who learn to read and write in Slovakia at the end of the century are learning to read and write in Hungarian. Now, if you have an education where you learn Hungarian, you learn to spell Hungarian, you learn to write Hungarian, you're bilingual, you speak Hungarian, you read Hungarian, you write Hungarian, that knowledge of the Latin alphabet means that you can read Slovak. And if you speak Slovak, then you can kind of read Slovak as well. What it doesn't mean, though, is that you can write Slovak. It doesn't mean you can write with great precision. There have been many different ways to spell, you know, that the one orthography has an IE, the other one has an E accent, the other has a JE. There could be all these fine discussions about how this particular diphthong should sound. And if you come from a part of the world where the standard language isn't based on that script, isn't based on the local pronunciation of that town, which is most of Slovakia, you have a regional dialect anyway. So none of the choices available to you, not Czech, not Hatulovčina, not Biblichtina, not Sturovčina, none of them is going to perfectly capture your pronunciation. Your speech is dialectical. So which of these standard languages do you learn? None of them, because you learn Hungarian instead. This is why I think the interwar Czechoslovakia is the decisive moment where Slovak nationalism becomes crystallized and coalesced. Before the 20th century, there's lots of people who can read and write, but none of them can read and write at the high level of literacy that creates linguistic nationalism. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure. It does make sense.
I can express that pretty clearly.
Well, I'm just thinking about it from a slightly different perspective, and just thinking about, first of all, I was curious: do you see any signs of people who are writing Slovak using Hungarian orthography?
The how should we say this, unfriendly critics will say that the Calvinist orthography is just the Hungarian orthography. And it does indeed, it does resemble the Hungarian orthography in a lot of ways. Hungarian, the sound S, like the S in sit, in Hungarian is written with SZ or SZ, as we say here in New Zealand. That's sort of unusual. Everyone else, S is the S, and the SH or SZ or whatever it is the SH sound is written in a different way. So the Calvinists write the S sound with SZ, with SZ. So people say, oh, it's just Hungarian orthography. It's, you know, you can see how denationalized they are. I'm uncomfortable referring to any system orthography with any ethnonym. So I'm a little hesitant to say, oh, the Calvinist orthography is the Hungarian orthography. I'd be more comfortable to say Calvinist orthography resembles the Hungarian orthography rather than is. Does that make sense?
Sure. I want to come back to another point you were saying. You were talking about how the Stur gets together with some Catholics and they come up with the trans-confessional Slovak orthography.
Mm.
And yet, if I understood your book, one of the interesting things is that Stur comes up with his orthography in a sense to say, we can be good Hungarians. We're not, don't confuse us with those Czechs over there.
That's correct.
And that creates an interesting irony, because on the one hand, you're talking about Magyarization, which most people, at least, again, outside of Slovak studies, would probably generally say, you know, what's the difference? Hungarianization, Magyarization, and
I think there's a big difference. Hungarian history tends to be written as Magyar history, because the Hungarians went around and said, we are the only Hungarians. Hungary, Magyar, it's the same thing. We are the only Hungarians. Well, and eventually they won that argument, but they won it at the cost of losing all of their non-Magyar territories. So you have to be careful what you wish for. When my story opens at the time of the French Revolution, the idea of the nation in Hungary means the nobility. There's this concept in Latin called the Natio Hungarica, and it means members of the Hungarian nobility. The Natio Hungarica is a multi-ethnic, multilingual entity. You can be a member of the Natio Hungarica and speak, say, Croatian, because you're a nobleman, and that's the definition of the nation. With the French Revolution, with the rise of the national idea, these class-exclusive ideas of the nation disappear. So the initial idea is a thing that retroactively we might call the Hungaris concept, which is everyone who lives in Hungary is a member of the nation, no matter what language you speak. And there are, in the very early years of the 19th century, various ephemera and texts that suggest a Hungarian national idea to which everyone belongs. The ethnic Hungarians, however, decide they don't like the Hungaris idea, and they want to have a more monolingual idea. They want to assimilate everyone. They want Magyarization. That story is well known. So people talk about the Hungaris idea as something that's transient, it doesn't go anywhere, and so on and so forth. Well, it certainly doesn't go anywhere among the Magyars. But I would suggest that it puts very deep roots down among the non-Magyars, that if you look at the Slovaks and if you look at the Croats and so forth, then you will find that they are not declaring their independence so much as fighting for civil rights inside the context of Hungary. The slogan that they adopt is, we are Hungarians, not Magyars. And I have a lot in my book about how you make that lexical distinction between Hungarian and Magyar, Uhor, Magyar, and so forth in the various languages of the Hungarian kingdom. And it's very interesting that the Hungarians refuse to understand, oh, what does this mean, Hungary, Magyar? I don't understand this distinction at all. Ha, 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 ha. This is Byzantine Greek. It makes no sense to me. This crazy hair splitting, precisely as a technique to delegitimate any non-Magyar claims to Hungarian citizenship. So it's a sort of interesting case where this Whorfian argument of linguistic relativity is used as a political argument, and I found that fascinating enough to publish an article on. But But it has big political consequences, as you say, for Stur. I suggest that Stur is a Hungarian loyalist. And his goal for Slovaks is not a Slovak state, but for them to have civil rights inside Hungary. And he wants to see a multi-ethnic, tolerant Hungary. A lot of people like to see Stur as a sort of Garibaldi figure. You know, he's going to liberate the nation. And I suggest in my book that maybe a more appropriate analogy is a sort of Martin Luther King character, that he's fighting for civil rights and reconciliation with the Hungarians. It doesn't work out for him. The Hungarians insist on this modularization policy. You know, complicated story made simple. They insist on modularization. And the Slovak efforts to create a multi-ethnic Hungary don't go anywhere. But just because something fails doesn't mean that it wasn't profoundly believed in at the time. So this is a very surprising picture of Stur. I cite in my book all sorts of people who picture Stur as a freedom fighter who hated the Magyars, who fought Hungary, because they conflate the idea of hating the Magyars and hating Hungary. Stur did have a bit of tension with the Magyars, but I would suggest that he is fighting not against Hungary, but for Hungary. He's fighting for a multi-ethnic, for a multilingual Hungary. And that's, I think, a pleasing and interesting conclusion, particularly in light of historiographical stereotypes that Western nationalism, quote-unquote, is tolerant and multi-ethnic, whereas nasty Eastern nationalism in Eastern Europe is intolerant. Ludovic Stur is a brilliant counterexample.
Yeah, it's a very persuasive argument on that. While we're talking about contingency and different ways of looking at you know, different ideas of constructing identity in the 19th century, could you, one of the particular options that again fails that you talk about is the North Slavic identity.
I wondered if you would ask about that. There is a very transient political movement for the North Slavs of Hungary to join together in a single unit. So in contemporary terms, it's Magucci's Rusins plus Slovaks equals single unit North Hungarian Slavs. And this is not a very successful political movement. It doesn't really go anywhere. The people who are purporting it or who are propounding it are doing so from very transparent tactical motives. They're doing it because they want to have an electoral alliance in the forthcoming election, you know, something like that.
Which election would be that? Would that be 1861 or something? Or
1861, yeah. It also pops up every now and then in 1848, 49. You can see that Stur and Dobryansky are thinking about an alliance against Kossuth, and you know, there are various traces and trends of this. I wrote an article on this actually, but unfortunately it was rejected, and I really should send it off because it's been sitting on my computer for something like 6 years. But anyway, there is this refashion that doesn't really go anywhere. I'm interested in that sort of thing because it shows that people invoke national ideas sometimes for very tactical concerns. And people talk about nationalism as, or national loyalties or national identities, quote unquote, as these primordial things that exist forever and are very firmly held, very enduring. And if that's your approach to nationalism, then I think you really have to struggle to explain why it is that people would use the word nation in these very unexpected contexts.
If I may ask just a bit, you know, the North Slav identity you're talking about, isn't it already sort of a fallback position of an earlier hope that there be a kind of pan-Slavic within a pan-Slavic identity within Hungary that embraced Croatians, it would embrace Serbs, and then the Slovaks and the.
There's lots of evidence for a sense of we are the Slavs of Hungary, and there's lots of Slovaks who are corresponding with or collaborating with Slovaks. The Slovaks have very close ties with Ludovic Gaj in Zagreb. And so the Slavs of Hungary is a very lively and interesting movement. But the North Hungarian Slavic movement doesn't have anything to do with the Croats. It's purely a Slovak Rusyn thing, and that's kind of unusual.
But isn't that because the Croats had already sort of said, you know, you guys, you're not us, and certainly the Serbs had done that. Did I understand that correctly? That they, you know, the North Slovaks, you know, idea, or rather North Hungary idea. For Slavs is because the South Slavs have already sort of said, you know, we're going our separate way.
Well, the short answer to the question is I'm not sure. But I do find it hard to believe that the Croats had turned their backs completely on Slavic Brotherhood in 1861.
Okay, that's a fair answer. I certainly can't refute, as that's not something I'm particularly sharp on.
I think that the legislative pan-Slavism is really interesting. And the idea that all Slavs are the same people speaking the same language is surprisingly enduring. And it makes it hard to understand sometimes, or it makes it hard to distinguish sometimes, between a Slovak who says, I'm so proud to be Slovensky. Look at our wonderful Slovensky land. Look at my beautiful castle. It is a wonderful Slovensky castle. So does that word Slovensky mean Slavic, or does it mean Slovak particularist? And sometimes the text will say, the Slovensky language. It is so beautiful. You can hear the Slovensky language everywhere in the world, even in the Caucasus Mountains. Well, that would seem to suggest that the Slovensky language means, in our contemporary terminology, Slavic. Because there is no vision of Slovak nationalism that extends to the Caucasus. And if someone says, Slovensky language, it is so wonderful, you can hear it across northern Hungary from Prešov to Bratislava. That would seem to suggest Slovak particularism. But even the Slovak particularism, you can't be sure. Maybe it's just the local manifestation of a broader Slavdom. I think people are very keen to see Slovak particularist nationalism because they want 19th century pan-Slavs to be anticipating the future Slovak nationalism. And I imagine that a lot of the incidences of Slovak nationalism that are cited in the literature really more express the Slavism of people who happen to be living in Hungary.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense, and which takes us to the issue of really the Hungarian context. Now, you start in the book with a chapter on that, but in some ways it really comes home to roost when the Hungarian context disappears, so that we really see suddenly what all those years of a few people talking amongst each other about being Slovak versus the general tendency that the vast majority of Slovaks of lesser economic means, for the most part, have experienced in a society, in a state that was encouraging education, and certainly with certain desire that be a major education, but nonetheless. Let's take it on the face of it. It was an education. They wanted them to be educated. Mm. And that, to a certain extent, these groups of people that you talk about don't, even though they've been talked about in every Slovak national history, you sort of demonstrate that they were cut off from the real reality. And it's only the new reality of Czechoslovakia, which is a peculiar event in itself, or development in itself, because it was hardly expected, that begins to really make sense of this and give empower that small, relatively small circle of people.
The story I tell about national awakening is ironic from top to bottom. The great founder of the Slovak language, quote-unquote, by codifying the Slovak script, Ludovic Štúr did so from a combination of Pan-Slav motives and Hungarian loyalism. Czechoslovakia founded by people who believed in a Czechoslovak nation, who promoted Czechoslovak unity, very sincerely, I suggest, counterproductively pursued policies that generated Slovak particularist nationalism. I think that it comes from the legacy of Pan-Slavism insofar as the legacy of Pan-Slavism purported this idea that you could have a single language with different scripts. The Pan-Slavs look at Russian in the Cyrillic alphabet, Polish in the Latin alphabet, and in a particular Latin alphabet, you know, with the O accent and the L with the little diagonal line, the W sound, that they look at Czech, they look at Bulgarian, they look at Slovene, and they say these are all dialects of a greater language. It doesn't matter that this book is in Cyrillic and that book is in Latin alphabet because it's just a written dialect. I argue that this is not going to work. I argue that linguistic nationalism is not about the language you speak, not even about the language you read, but about the language that you write. I argue that people who learn to write in one alphabet are going to form a different interest group to create a different linguistic movement than people who write in another alphabet. But my Slovaks and the Czechoslovaks don't think that way. They believe that you can have a single language with different written forms. Even when the Pan-Slav idea dies, the idea of a single language with different written forms lives on. So you have in Yugoslavia the idea of Serbo-Croat. Some of us use a Latin alphabet, some of us use a Cyrillic alphabet, same language, Serbo-Croat. That doesn't work either, but it takes a while for that not to work. In Czechoslovakia, you have it doesn't last as long as Serbo-Croat, but you have a similar idea that, okay, well, we in Bohemia, we write in these letters. You in Slovakia, you write with those letters. We have our spellings, you have your spellings, but it's all one language. The concept is of one language, even though the scripts are different. Because of this idea of the one language, different written forms, the Czechoslovak government creates a Slovak nationalist intelligentsia because it creates mass education, mass literacy in a uniquely Slovak script. So it's sort of ironic because they wanted to build Czechoslovakia, and in the end, they pursued a policy that destroyed the possibility of Czechoslovakia. I think that if the Czechoslovak government had just introduced Czech into Slovak schools, it would have worked. I think the number of people who were literate at a high level in Slovakia was so low, they could have learned Slovak. Yeah, the letters would have been different from what they were used to. But so the Hatala of China was also different from what most people were used to, because most people who learned to read and write had learned to read and write in Hungarian anyway. I found evidence that when today's modern Slovak, quote-unquote, Hatalivchina, was introduced in eastern Slovakia, there were protests against this Czech, down with this Czech, and this script that they were objecting to, this grammar book that they were objecting to as Czech and therefore foreign, was Slovak. If the Slovak can survive and be introduced, if the Slovak can be rejected as Czech and still survive, still take root, I don't see why Czech couldn't also have survived and taken root. Nevertheless, the Czechoslovak government, whatever reason, chose not to pursue this path. Because of this idea of the literary dialects. But it's an ironic story because they wanted to create Czechoslovak unity, and the path they pursued created disunity.
No, and I think that's a very interesting perspective on what happens. I mean, to what extent are they also driven by having to deal with, you know, some of the more conservative elements of the Slovak political class? And for some reason, his name is escaping me.
Linke?
Yes, yeah, Linke, right, exactly. For some reason, just wouldn't come out of my mouth.
So you're asking about Linke?
Right.
Well, Linke is the first example, I think, of a mass movement of Slovak particularist nationalism. So the Hlinka movement is important. But I think there's a tendency in the interwar period to overestimate how important it is. I think they win at maximum some 20% of the vote. Now, 20% is significant, but it does mean that 80% of the electorate rejects their ideas. So they play an interesting role because they're important, but at the same time, they're not as important as some people seem to think they are.
Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you about this, and I'm looking forward to whatever else you produce. So you've already got projects in line, and if you could tell us a little bit about where you're heading there.
Well, my next book, which is all written, is a book about nationalism and clothing. The title is Patriots Against Fashion. I have a book contract and everything. All I need to do is get the copyright clearances for all the pictures I want to use. So I'm hoping that will come out in the next 9 months or something. That's a European-wide book, and it looks at this transformation to the national idea, as we were talking about before. And it's a European comparative book, and it has individual chapters on Wales and Bulgaria and Russia and Spain, and it's very Catholic in its geographic scope. And then I've been doing a lot of work on Hungary, and that may at some point turn into a book as well. But I don't know. I never have trouble thinking of projects. My problem is to bring my projects to fruition. I'm also working on an edited volume right now called Germanness Beyond Germany with a colleague in Sydney. And that book will be about what does it mean to be German in various expatriate communities beyond the core German ethno-territory. My chapter is about Germans in Hungary. I've become very interested in Hungarian history proper from this Slovak research. My colleague works on Transylvania, so he's going to write about the German communities in Transylvania. But other chapters talk about German communities in Argentina and in Israel and in China and various parts of the world.
Sounds quite intriguing. And yes, Germanness abroad. I think there's lots to be done there. And it doesn't have to be seen from the all German perspective that it once was. And finally, look, you're an established scholar. What suggestions do you have for new scholars of Eastern Europe?
I think, how shall I approach this question? My suggestion for new scholars is publish, publish, publish. That's the career suggestion. But the direction I would like to see East European studies move is to move away from the Second World War and particularly away from the Holocaust. The thing I fight most with my students is that in the mind of the students I have in New Zealand, and I think this is also true in North America as well, Eastern Europe is that place where the Holocaust happened. And East European nationalism, that means people killing each other, and it means anti-Semitism. Eastern Europe is also a place, however, of life and culture and creativity, and there's all sorts of other things going on other than anti-Semitism. And I think that we are starting to get a distorted view of what Eastern Europe is all about because there's so much emphasis on the Holocaust. I sometimes, in my spare time, go to chat rooms and waste time there. And I happened to meet a man once that I was chatting with from Poland, and he was from a town I didn't know. I can't remember what town it is. But I looked it up on the Wikipedia to see what there was to say about this town on the Wikipedia page. And the Wikipedia page of this town looked as follows. There was a paragraph that said this town was founded in the Middle Ages. It was part of the Lithuanian-Polish Commonwealth. It became part of the Russian partition. It joined Poland in the interwar period, 500 years, 1,000 years of Polish history in one paragraph. Then there were six paragraphs on the Jews of this town and that they'd what happened to them in the Holocaust. And then there were two paragraphs on this town has a football team. Is that a fair description of a town in Eastern Europe that the Holocaust is six paragraphs and everything else is three paragraphs? I think that's disproportionate. The scholarly work is more balanced, of course, than the Wikipedia pages. But I still think at my institution, we get these alerts to do new books in Eastern European studies. Which books do you recommend the library should buy? And it seems it falls into equal, the books in Eastern Europe fall into equal halves. Books on the Holocaust, books on everything else. So I would urge scholars of Eastern Europe to try to see other things other than anti-Semitism, and that when they see examples of nationalism in the 19th century, maybe even an example of nationalism that has an anti-Semitic twinge to it, that there can be context for that other than this leads to the Holocaust.
Yes, well, there were definitely other possible directions, as I think your book, in a certain, you don't talk about Jews really very much at all, given the focus, but there were many different options.
Well, my story ends before the Second World War begins, really. And there aren't a lot of Jews who are attracted to Slovak loyalties. Jews in Hungary in the 19th century are more attracted to being Hungarian. So they assimilate to a more Magyar way of looking at Hungary. So they don't play a big role in my story.
No. I'm not suggesting that they should have. I'm just saying that it does. You know, there were other possibilities, and that's one of the great things about your book, is you remind us of other possibilities.
Jewish history is very interesting, but things other than Jewish history are also interesting. And I think people are too interested. I mean, the Holocaust is a very important event that people should understand. But I think that battle is kind of won for East European studies. I think actually we now face the alternate challenge of teaching people that there's more to Poland than Auschwitz, that there's more to East European nationalism than the Second World War.
No, I think that will come. I mean, one of the things that had to happen is for Eastern Europe also for World War II, let's say, to end as it finally did in 1989, so people can finally get on with it.
Yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, Alexander, and I wish you the best.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and I wish you the best as well. And next year in Eastern Europe.
Right. Okay. Well, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Alexander Maxwell about his book, Choosing Slovakia, published by Taurus Academic Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and I'm thanking you for joining me today on New Books in Eastern European Studies, and I hope you'll join me again when I speak to another author about his book. Bye-bye.